Cliff.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. As that song means, Cliff Schechter is kind enough to join us here for the full hour today. You can find Cliff Schechter in numerous places, including the podcast Unprecedented from Patreon. Fantastic. If you're not subscribed, you need to get subscribed to that. And then Blue Amp Strategies. If you have got a campaign coming up, especially 2022, and you need some messaging help, Blue Amp Strategies is a proven success track record that Cliff can help you with your campaign as well. So I'll make sure we put the links out for all that on social media a little bit later on. Cliff Schechter, once again, kind enough to join us. Hey, Cliff.
Hey there. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time this holiday season.
Of course. You know, what would it be if we didn't have a little insurrection to talk about, some betrayal, some treachery?
Nothing screams Santa more than a 1-6 insurrection, does it? Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing like the holidays to really recap what a wonderful year we've had in this so-called democracy of ours and where we may be headed. So I am more than I kid. I can't help but have a morbid sense of humor where things are. But at the same time, I'm obviously serious and I'm happy to be here talking to you. So thank you.
No, my pleasure. And let's start with that. From what we've learned and where this is going, it's very clear that maybe not all the parties involved were, you know, as nefarious as others, but there clearly were people that were saying, no, if we're not going to win this election fairly, we'll steal this country away and we'll control it for the next 100 years. There definitely seems to be enough evidence at this point, at least from what we've seen, that there was a coordinated effort within members of the Republican Party, within the White House, to basically overthrow the democracy of the United States of America on January 6th.
Yeah. You said it in a way that I don't think I can add anything at least to that. It's sad. It's tragic. It's hard to believe. You know, I don't like to feel like – I like to think that you and I are relatively well-educated people and not gullible people. And, you know, maybe you grew up with the same sort of feeling I had, that with its many flaws – you know, America was still kind of moving in a forward direction and trying to better our democracy, have it be a democracy for more people, move more in a direction of justice. And I thought, you know, that the people, there are always these cynical SOBs, if I can say that, there were even some Democrats, but certainly many in the Republican Party who didn't believe that. But I thought the sort of basic principles, you know, they believed in, you know, going into 2016, I did think Republicans actually wouldn't want to turn our country over to Vladimir Putin, and all that stuff they'd said about the Soviet Empire for years were things they actually maybe believed, at least to a certain degree. I would have believed that they wouldn't want to crash our economy and you know, with debt ceiling shenanigans, and believed in what they said about wanting to create a more prosperous nation for all of us. I mean, I did believe at least some basic things, even from these bad people. And it's really kind of it's shocking to learn that there's so many among us that apparently don't love this country, don't even like it, don't have any belief, any investment at all in democracy, in our republic. There's obviously numerous examples of that. What's come out from the 1-6 committee, whether it's Mark Meadows, a former congressman, you know, and chief of staff to Trump, trying to do what he can to help Trump overturn it. Numerous right wing, but they were lawyers who theoretically believed in democracy, like that Eastman joker. Even some goofball like Rick Perry. I mean, who you could just sit there and laugh at, right? Remember when he went on Dancing with the Stars?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what an utter goofball that guy was. But he was governor of Texas. He was Secretary of Energy. And now we find out the text basically saying to Meadows, hey, why don't you just have the states, you know, with these questions, meaning they had questions. Nobody who actually follows any of this and in an honest way had any questions who won. But why don't we just have the states send the electors we want? I mean, that's an out-and-out coup.
Mm-hmm.
And it's shocking. But it's going on here. It's ongoing. We had three generals write an op-ed to the Washington Post this week saying they're worried there could be divisions in the military. I mean, they studied the fact that 1 in 10 of those who attacked the Capitol on January 6th were either veterans or current in the military. And so, I mean, yeah, You know, they got behind everything these guys. That's the irony is everything. The Republican Party had become so decrepit, so corrupt, that this unbelievable, this failure of a joke of a con man was able to come in and take ownership of all of these people, because they propagandized their voters with Fox and Rush Limbaugh to the point where they could tell their people anything. And whoever had the loudest voice and said it in the most comical way and maybe the most famous name would convince them. And that ended up being Donald Trump in the end. Yeah. They created this, and this is where we are. And there's a whole lot of people I thought, you know, I thought were awful in their politics, but actually believed in basic democracy. And it turns out they don't believe in democracy at all.
Trump played these people. He saw the opportunity and played them like fools. And they don't even see how badly they've been played. A lot right now is weighing on SCOTUS, the Supreme Court. There is a court ruling out there that says unless the Supreme Court steps in here, that he's no longer the president. So he can't invoke executive privilege, especially when it comes to an undeniable crime like the insurrection. You can't do that. It's interesting. There is when you look at the Supreme Court, most people think that even with the far right stance, that they're not going to set this precedent, that a president is basically becomes untouchable for life, that you have to have some way to be able to look at them and hold them accountable if there's a crime. But at the same time, there are people that are sort of suggesting, well, the White House, what they might be able to do is stall a ruling until next year, the year afterwards, with 2023. The beginning of that would be the ruling coming down and hoping and just saying to the Republicans, here's the deal, win back the House, and then this thing all goes away. But until that time, we're going to be the case. I don't know where they're going to go, but my part of me wants to believe that Roberts is not going to allow that to happen. He's saying this is pretty clear cut, that he doesn't have executive privilege. But, I mean, there is that potential out there. What's your thoughts on where this is going to go with the SCOTUS?
Well, it's kind of scary how SCOTUS is, like, how the numbers have broken down in a way that I don't even know that I would have predicted. At this point, it seems like that within the extremist right, there's actually further right factions on that court. I'm pretty much of the mind at this point that Alito, Clarence Thomas, and Gorsuch are basically fascists who would do anything for their party. I don't think a legal principle matters much to any one of them. Shockingly, Coney Barrett and Kavanaugh seem to actually only be, you know, major right-wing extremists, and maybe not fascists, and are actually, you know, not where those guys are. And then Roberts, who is solidly conservative, and you can't even call him that, who is right-wing, is not where they are. So I don't think they're going to get a majority of five to do that. And, you know, even if they somehow were, I mean, the bigger damage would be creating an imperial presidency forever. But there's enough people out there. I mean, a classic example would be someone like Steve Bannon, who's in the middle of all this. He wouldn't have executive privilege no matter what. He didn't work for the White House while all that was going on. So it doesn't matter. He has no claim whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even if somehow they try to shield, you know, allow Trump to shield his crimes, you know, with Meadows and some of the others, the people who were not part of that White House would have no claim there. And so I don't see it happening. But I think the really important part is what you said initially. As numerous smart prosecutors have pointed out, and former prosecutors, they're behaving like mobsters because that's essentially what they are. What mobsters do is they try to run out the clock. They appeal forever. They try to make it such a pain in the butt, so difficult, so expensive, so whatever, for everybody to go after them that you just give up. And here, it's even different than that because, as you pointed out, they have an actual clock where they're assuming they're going to take the House back and they can then just shut down the January 6th committee. They won't be able to take back the Justice Department until at least 2025. But, I mean, again, it does make you ask questions, and it's why so many people have gotten frustrated and want to know what the hell Merrick Garland's actually doing. I mean, a lot of this stuff was committed out in the open. It's terrific that they've prosecuted so many people that were there that day, and somebody just got a five-year sentence.
Yeah.
Who infamously threw a fire extinguisher at a police officer, and good. He deserves it personally. The message that sends that people that do these kinds of things will pay a price is good. But where are all the people up top? And what, you know, we would hear about it as, well, again, people smarter than me who are legal types would say if they were paneling grand juries and they were sending out subpoenas, we'd know there'd be leaks, there'd be whatever. And so I don't know what I've tried to have the most sort of positive, you know, take on it. But at the same time, I'm not going to be Pollyannish. This is my democracy. Mm-hmm. And it frustrates the hell out of me that that we're dealing with something here that is unlike anything else we've dealt with. This isn't a mob trial. This isn't a trial of some people that you know, Teapot Dome or something that stole government resources. It's an ongoing coup. And because of that, and because that these people retaining their credibility is dangerous to us, people like Trump and Meadows, and because they could actually win back power, even more dangerous to us, like, there needs to be urgency here.
Yeah.
And there needs to be more urgency. Frankly, I like what the January 6th committee is doing, but in terms of holding these guys accountable, I mean, I see the you know, I'm not a legal scholar, but whether they go to the Justice Department and they request that these guys be held responsible, and then we find out that Bannon is you know, he's pushed a hearing all the way back to July of next year, mm-hmm. right? There are inherent contempt procedures that are quicker. I don't know all the details. I don't know why they're not doing them. This is a hair on fire moment. This is a moment of urgency. This is a moment where Merrick Garland should be communicating with us every damn week about what's going on, because this is only our democracy after all.
Yeah.
And he doesn't have to, you know, give us details that like they shouldn't do to upend individual investigations. But geez, let us know something. Let us know that you're on the case, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those three generals I brought up, even part of their op-ed piece, said there needs to be more urgency. You know, they said the same thing as many other legal minds have said, like, what's going on here? So it's frustrating because we don't know.
One of the things that's interesting, you go back and watch Watergate, you go read through that, and you realize that after the fact, they were trying to set up fall guys, you know, people to fall on the spear, that sort of thing. And right. they put that plan into motion too late for it to save Nixon. They're clearly, at least to me, in the last week or so, I have noticed that there seems to be movement within the Trump camp to basically segregate out a handful of people to be potential fall guys. Mark Meadows, as you said. I mean, he clearly is setting himself up to be a fall guy. This last weekend, we had Bannon get called out by Roger Stone saying this was Bannon's plan. Bannon was the one that wanted to overthrow the government. Bannon was the person that ordered these people to go the places that they are. It's Bannon's fault. I mean, it was very clear. That wasn't a mixed message. They're throwing Bannon his name there. And you brought up Eastman, the one guy, the lawyer who basically wrote the coup memo. It seems to me right now that they're trying to shore up those three particularly, maybe a congressman too, but those three specifically, they're trying to shore up as these are the real culprits. And that I'm almost expecting Trump to come on out and have a, I can't believe these three betrayed me. We were just trying to have a happy party. And then they went out there and tried to kill my vice president. I can see that happening.
They just want to celebrate the day.
Yeah.
They're just so good for Joe Biden.
Exactly. So, I mean, what is your thought? I mean, do you get the impression that that's what's happening, is that fall guys are starting to take shape?
I'm sure they are. Trump's not smart enough himself to think ahead 10 minutes, much less. But he's got enough people. Who, as I said, that's the depressing part about all this, is what we've learned is if he pays enough money, he can find willing sycophants who will overthrow democracy, or at least try for him, that have literally no attachment to the democratic experiment and history and culture of this country, as it should be. So I'm sure those folks are out there trying to find people. And hell, the funny thing is, some of them may be some of the fall guys. I mean, again, with the mobster kind of comparison, there's always something like that going on with them too. You know, this is pretty much the case. So there are people that are setting people up. And again, the thing about Trump, right, is, I mean, I think the Lincoln Project guy, what's his name, was famous for the everything Trump touches dies.
Oh.
But that's been a sort of a kind of a thoroughfare, you know, a sort of lane in this man's life forever, is that he is just a toxic sludge that destroys everything around him. And what's amazing, I guess, is to see again and again these utterly stupid, short-sighted people who throw in with him only to have him betray them the minute it becomes convenient to him and the minute they don't 100% do what he wants. I mean, he sent a crowd, as he knew a crowd was there, putting up makeshift gallows and chanting to hang Mike Pence. While that was going on, he tweeted out that he couldn't believe Mike Pence had betrayed, you know, I don't remember the language he used on the tweet in front of me, but he couldn't believe Mike Pence didn't have the courage to stand up. I mean, can you imagine? Talk about inciting further, this man is probably, you know, not that I'm ever going to have any sympathy for Mike Pence, who went along with just about all of this until the last moment. But this man's running around with his family trying to escape an angry horde who want to hang him at the Capitol. And Trump is sending out tweets essentially like, yeah, hang him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what you're dealing with. That's the level of immorality. That's the level of sociopathy you're dealing with here. So anybody who thinks they're safe, and by the way, that includes Don Jr.
Oh, yeah.
And Melania. And really anybody.
Ivanka would be safe. I think that Trump would do anything in his power to save her. No one else.
I think he would do anything in his power to save her except for throw himself. He would be the last one he would throw overboard. I think if you're putting together an order of operations, there's no doubt Eric's out the window right away, maybe just for the fun of it, just for being who he is. But, I think you're right that there's some many other sicknesses there in his love for her that I don't even want to get into.
Yeah.
And my guess is he would wait. You know, that would be the kind of desperation move he would only do if he had to. But I think if he had to, he would. Most of the other folks, he'll throw them away like yesterday's dirty laundry. He doesn't care. Mark Meadows and all of them, they mean nothing to him. They're transactional figures. They did for him what he needed them to do at that time. And they never get that, it seems, until they become destroyed by him. And a whole bunch of people are going to go to jail, whether he does or not. A whole bunch of these other people will definitively go to jail, and they'll do it because of that, which is just – it's pathetic is what it is.
The one saving grace, I mean, if you want a positive light out of this, it seems that the moderate Republicans are starting to wake up, because you look at polling about the 1-6 insurrection, and the numbers are pretty consistent, and they've actually been getting more to the side of holding these guys accountable. 60 to 60+% want these people held accountable. There is always that Trump loyalist crowd, that 30%, that 35% that doesn't want anything to happen. But there are more than just Democrats, more than just independents. There are Republicans that are looking at this and saying, you know what? No, this is I like my party, but I'm not going to throw out this country's democracy just for my party. That seems to be something that the Republicans are going to have to deal with. And if something pushes Republican Party leaders to throw, whether that's Congress people, senators, or Trump himself under the bus, it's the fact that the last thing they want to do is put it out there that looks like they're most of the people want them held accountable, and they're not going to listen to that.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the, you know, and that's, I wouldn't even know if I call that group you're talking about Trump loyalists as much as sort of the fascist rump. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's like that 30% that honestly, they create concentration camps tomorrow. I mean, I hate to say it, but it's true.
Yeah.
They'd do anything that the far right told them to do. They'll believe any conspiracy. Oh. They're the ones that show up waiting for JFK Jr. to come back.
Ones after Rittenhouse's trial that were talking about, correct. Yeah, you're dang right we can start shooting Democrats. And that was kind of their mentality.
Yes. So there's that group. I think you're right. There's a large other group. And I mean, the problem with the fact that Republicans, Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, all of their various media organs and everything have so corrupted our discourse and so sort of even the more, you know, pick whatever, reasonable, moderate, mainstream Republicans, whatever you want to call them. Even they, you know, the word Democrat and, you know, the words Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and others have been so demonized, so polluted, that I think they have a very hard time going over and doing the same thing, although obviously some of them did in 2020. But I do think clearly there's enough of them that realize that what happened on January 6th was horrid, and does, you know, if people are not punished, does not bode well for our country. So in all of their mixed allegiances and fear of AOC and, you know, other garbage that the Republican Party sells them, they at least are able to see that much. And I think you're right. And I think live hearings, again, it's why I want the impeachment hearings, as much of them to be on TV live. The live hearings have a way, it's much easier for Fox to, you know, in places like that, to dismiss stuff that people aren't seeing and hearing with their own eyes and ears.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the characters involved, the people who suffered, you know, whether it's the cops who were there or others, it's much harder for them to spin that when people are seeing and hearing and you know, that kind of thing. And obviously a lot of the information that's come out of Meadows' emails, which again is another example of the sort of hilarity of the world of Trump. I don't know what Meadows thought he was doing there. And maybe he thought he could have his cake and eat it too. Maybe he thought, because obviously Donald Trump is such a proudly stupid man, that it wouldn't be a big deal that he came out and said that he went on stage with COVID, you know, with Joe Biden, and maybe would have, could have gotten Joe Biden sick, and went and met with Gold Star families or those who've lost, you know, their kids in the military, who lost their lives and threatened their health too. Maybe they thought Trump, you know, maybe he thought it wouldn't, he could sell a lot of books, make a lot of money, and it would be the kind of thing Trump would be like, "You're damn right I did," you know?
Yeah.
But it turns out that Trump didn't like that. So now he's gotten really angry. He got really angry at Meadows. So Meadows, who'd been cooperating with this committee, suddenly backs out. And really now, in the end, he gets the worst of all worlds. Trump still doesn't trust him and hates him. He's done in terms of being trusted by Trump. But at the same time, he's now being held in contempt. And he already gave us plenty of stuff that maybe he was too stupid to look through.
Yes.
But I mean, you know, the Rick Perry text, the text from Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham and, you know, Kilmeade and Don Jr. I mean, already, and you were bringing up earlier, I mean, like that creates dissension. And that leads Trump to get angry. And now he's demanding even more loyalty, the kind of loyalty that even the sycophants can't always give him. And so he's getting mad, and he's kicking people out of his inner circle, and he's attacking Mitch McConnell constantly. And I mean, he's going to end up probably, like he ended up costing him those two seats in Georgia, but with some of his antics, you know, I think one could say that likely I can't say definitively, but he certainly likely helped cost them those two seats. I think there's a good chance that, you know, he can cost them a lot more in 22.
Yes or no? Do you think there'll be some level of accountability before the election of this next year?
I do.
You do.
I do. And I don't from some faith or whatever. I do from looking at what the committee is doing right now. And I guess from maybe just a belief in, I can't fathom that Merrick Garland can come in there into the DOJ and not pursue crimes against Trump. I just can't fathom it.
You're right, though. Merrick Garland, what are you doing, man? You need to kind of light a fire under your caboose, man, and get going on that. 9529.
Or at least let us know if you have gotten going, right?
Yeah, exactly.
We don't know anything.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, no one's going to look bad at you if you try to hold insurrectionists accountable. 952-946-6205. Cliff Schechter joining us for the full hour. Let's take a break. Come on back. We're going to talk about what the Democrats have to do to stop the derailing of Biden's agenda. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. Cliff Schechter, once again, kind enough to join us for the entire hour to talk about 2021 in review, looking forward to 2022. I think the most important thing, Cliff, though, is to talk about baseball. Of course, as you and I can talk here, I'm just grateful the freaking Houston Astros didn't win it. Oh, God. That would have been
all right. You're on the same page as me there.
Yeah.
Yes, I could not have lived with I shouldn't say that. I would have been very unhappy with them winning. I'm still angry at what happened in 2017. I still don't think Jose Altuve deserved the MVP, even not knowing. I still don't know how he won it over Aaron Judge. When you compare their numbers, he had a higher batting average, and I think he had one other higher number, and Judge dominated all around. But in any case, now we cheated too. They cheated. It's not the same thing. Baseball isn't politics, and it isn't as important when it comes to how it affects our lives. But I do think, you know, it's of a cultural piece with what's going on in Washington, that people that break the rules, that ignore the law of the game, the rules of the game, whatever you want to call it, and there's literally no punishment for them.
Yep.
There's no accountability. They don't have their World Series trophy vacated, which it should be.
Yes.
They don't have the individual awards they have. I mean, in 1994, as you know, when there was a strike – a little different than right now when there's a lockout, but when we're going through something at least similar where baseball wasn't happening, there was no World Series winner. And you know what? That was what the result of the fact that they couldn't get together.
Yeah.
The players and the owners. So there isn't, for the first time in baseball history, there's no World Series winner. Why does there need to be a World Series winner in 2017? If you didn't win, honestly, if you didn't even get there, honestly, I think Manfred's an awful head of baseball.
Commissioner,
he should have been gone. I mean, he's just terrible.
Yeah.
Again, what message does that send to other people who are going to cheat?
Well, and I love your point on society. You catch these guys red-handed, and the Red Sox, too. They catch them red-handed.
Yep.
And you do nothing. And, you know, I understand you're still holding people accountable for steroids in the Hall of Fame, but, I mean, that's nothing compared to the World Series itself. We can't trust if it's actually legit. Are the Yankees, are they eyeing anyone in the offseason to pick up?
You know, I don't know. They should be. All sorts of people.
Yes, they should.
They stunk last year. I mean, they did. Look, they won 90, whatever. I mean, they won a lot of games and whatever, but they, you know, they legitimately at one point could have come in fourth in their division. I mean, AL East at this point is no joke. And I think a lot of people are angry because, you know, everybody's like, oh, the Yankees spend so much and this and that. I mean, the interesting thing is, yeah, we used to be that way. But we have a similar payroll to the one we had in 2006. And our revenues have tripled to quadrupled since then.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're one of the – I think we're literally one of the two or three teams. We may be the third to last in terms of percentage of what we spend on payroll. So Hal Steinbrenner, George Steinbrenner's son, is just pocketing the money. I don't know what he's doing, but he's not building a championship team. And again, I guess they claimed that before they wanted to wait and see what the new terms were after the lockout, but they did make a one-year deal to Verlander. They were willing to do that, and they got outbid by Houston, who went to a crazy 2 years. They were willing to make a six-year offer to Semien, but Texas added a seventh. You know, we used to just be the ones who were willing to put the most money down. And I'm not saying – I don't always think that's the way to go, right? I don't want to just buy players and give them outlandish sums of money. I think that can be stupid. But the unwillingness to even engage in the process, you know, to talk to them, to try and – I mean, so who do I – I mean, look, Corey Seager was a perfect fit for New York, but that's that.
Yeah.
Texas got him. Who at this point?
I was just going to say, I mean, at least you can say it like that. I mean, the Twins are acting like, hey, we figured out who our new hot dog vendor is going to be. And I'm like, geez, really? This is where we're at. I mean, every pitcher we got rid of, we should have kept last year. And every pitcher we kept, we should have gotten rid of. And it just, I mean, we're in a hole. Now we got a lot of money, but you need to do something more than that. I would like to see Justin Morneau. I hope Morneau makes the Hall of Fame. I don't think he will. I don't think he will. But, you know, he was a very – one of those guys that, as a Twins fan, I think if I'm already at this point, this is what I'm expecting of this year. I'm just kind of like, okay, make Morneau hit – get the Hall of Fame. I mean, I really do think it's – it is pretty sad that this is kind of where we are now.
You re-signed Buxton, right?
Yeah, Buxton's hit with us for a while, but I mean, he's Mr. Glass. I mean, a light breeze will break his arm. I mean, it's –
Did you guys bring somebody? Did you sign anybody else? I felt like you made a deal or trade, or did you do something? Or no? Am I thinking of
somebody else? I think he's the guy that's going to be in the bear costume. That's who we got him. Well, we got him.
That gets me angry too. Like the way I see it is there should be. I don't think there should be a hard cap because. I do think there should be some room for teams to maneuver and to do things they want to do and whatever. But what I do think there should be is both a floor and a ceiling. And I don't think they should be enormously far apart. I don't think any team should be spending eight times what another team is spending. You know what I mean? I think that if you're going to allow certain teams, and they are now the Mets and Dodgers, it's pretty funny the Yankees aren't in that group, are both spending north of $250 million. I don't think teams should be able to have it under $100 million payroll, or I think they should you should be forced to sell the team.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe put a cap on it and say you can't go above $300 million because you really should not. I mean, a team outspending another team by more than 3-1 is ridiculous.
It is. No, that is. No, and okay, you and I can't. I mean, you and I could talk a full 3 hours on baseball every day, I think, at the end of it. But we got to get back to politics there. Good luck.
Okay.
Out of the compassion of the holiday season, best of luck to your Yankees team.
And your Minnesota Twins too, who I actually don't dislike. I'm perfectly good with.
I like.
You want to beat up on the Indians? Guardians.
Guardians. I'm okay with beating up on the Guardians. We'll have to see. I will say this: I'm a little concerned about Atlanta and San Francisco for the next 20 years because I think both those teams are built to last. All right. So that aside, Speaking of built to last, the 50 vote majority in the Democrats had in the Senate.
I don't know if that's built to last.
That's definitely not. We've had a lot of problems. I mean, Joe Manchin right before the holidays says, I'm not going to sign on to the rest of the. I mean, it's clear why the latest bill was removed from the infrastructure bill, because he wanted the infrastructure bill passed. He'd vote for that independently, but he wouldn't vote for this. He is single-handedly, and let's be honest, he's doing the bidding of a handful of very wealthy donors who basically want the rest of Biden's agenda, you know, dismantled, and he has no problem doing that, and he's delivering. And Kristen Sinema from Arizona as well. This has always been the problem, though. You get a 50-50 split in the Senate with the Democrats holding the majority because just of the vice president's vote. It was always – there wasn't a lot of wiggle room.
No, and also just the same thing that puts us at a massive disadvantage against authoritarians in the Republican Party also puts us at a disadvantage against the people who act in bad faith in our own caucus. And there always are a couple of them, right? I mean, it's Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema today. You know, a decade ago it was Joe Lieberman and Ben Nelson. You know, you can go back further to 1994 when Bill Clinton was trying to pass the stimulus, or 1993. And there are those couple of Kent Conrad and a couple. There's just always a few. And these guys know that the Senate is just such a screwed up institution at this point. It's like molasses. And so if they can get to one or two people, even when the Democrats have a solid majority, they've been able to find a way to get to enough people to you know, it's not to say that great things haven't been done. And I think that's important for Democrats to remind people in a message. The COVID stimulus bill, which you meant the stimulus checks that were going to people, the money that got vaccinations and testing out there and all the rest. I mean, that was hugely important. The first infrastructure bill, which we act like, yeah, that was a smaller one. That was the one Manchin wanted, and that was the one that Republicans even some agreed to. But Joe Biden did what he said he was going to do. He brought Democrats and Republicans together, even it was many more Democratic votes, and they passed a hugely important bill, because our bridges and our basic infrastructure is a joke at this point. It's falling apart. You want to take a look somewhere? Look at what China's doing versus what we're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was important too. So I do think it's important to point out that there's you know, instead of if Democrats want to message us correctly, you should point out all the amazing things each of those bills did, because most people don't even know, because we stink at messaging, and I can't solve it. I've talked about it in my podcast, I've talked about it on Twitter, I've talked about it everywhere in my life. I don't know what it is about basic marketing that people who are the heads of various committees and communications can't sit there and pick three things that are obviously the most popular. Mm-hmm. I mean, now you're hearing a lot about the child tax credit, right? Because Manchin's blocking it by not allowing it to pass. Why weren't we hearing about it before when we were trying to pass the thing and letting people know that's what's in there, that if Manchin kills it, that's what he's going to kill? There's just a lot of frustration all around. But yes, 50 votes is always going to be 50 votes. It's a bare majority. We needed those wins in Maine and North Carolina that we didn't get last time. That would at least given us a little bit more room to operate. You know, we're going to have to figure this out, because the truth of the matter is it's not that Joe Manchin in the end has sort of done what he's done and he's doing the bidding of whoever he's doing, which is bad enough. He's clearly a bald-faced liar. I mean, he's a treacherous character. The White House doesn't generally do this kind of stuff, but, you know, Jen Psaki made pretty clear that they had his promise, and they wouldn't come out and say that out loud unless they were pretty pissed. I mean, he went and met with Biden privately and said, the framework you've got will work. We just need to work out the individual pieces within that. And now what's he doing? He's saying the framework doesn't work. These 10-year sunset clauses. Well, you know what? I don't like 10-year sunset clauses either. So why don't we then come up with a real bill that puts things into place permanently and picks the things that are most popular and that we care about the most and do them? And now I'll say quickly, Senator Wyden of Oregon, maybe almost anticipating. I don't know. Either he stayed up all night or he's anticipating Manchin's treachery. Came right back and jettisoned some things and made some other things permanent that were there, that I think were the things people cared about the most, to keep this thing at the same price without the 10-year gimmicks. And he's coming out. So if I believed in a word that Joe Manchin said, I'd say, all right, we're in a great place. Seems like Senator Wyden has solved the problem. But you just know that Manchin's going to move the goalposts again.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Because he keeps his leash is getting pulled. You know, his leash is getting pulled, and he's doing this because you know it's. And once again, this is the chronic problem with Democrats. Republicans can have a wide range of ideologies, and they will vote in unison every single stinking time. They've taken that argument of we'll never ask for permission, we'll ask for forgiveness, and they've made that a mantra which they will always run with, and that's why they have success. And success looks like integrity. Democrats can sit there and they are easily picked apart. Let's take a look back at the Affordable Care Act and how many weird provisions were put in that thing because Democrats were being pulled and pushed by donors who basically said, you got to put that in the bill or else I'm not going to give you donations. And so Democrats basically sabotage themselves half the damn time when it comes to this stuff because they're just too – they just don't have the integrity that they need to have.
Right. And I mean, the frustrating thing is, like, we're so much closer to having a caucus that is filled with people who have at least some integrity and aren't Joe Manchin types. Because again, if you go back to when things were going with the ACA, you may remember we had a much bigger majority, right? Mm-hmm. At that point in time, I mean, for a little while, we had 60, we had 59, I think, when the ACA passed, senators, you know, and at some other point there, I think I feel like we had 54 or 55. I'd have to look and see. The key point here is that we had all these senators who either just betrayed us and shouldn't have, like Joe Lieberman, who was from a pretty moderate state, or ones that were – we had all these senators from all these much more conservative states, like the Joe Manchin model where you're from West Virginia. You know, we had senators – we had people from Alabama and we had people from Utah. I mean, I'm not saying specifically, but we had a lot more, right? South Dakota, classic example, had two Democratic senators. Mm-hmm. North Dakota, I think, may have had two. They certainly had one Democratic senator. These are very conservative, right? Byron Dorgan and Kent Conrad and some of these types, and they would ditch us at every opportunity. So we finally have a more cohesive caucus where we're winning the more urban, suburban states that have been trending our way. And yet we're a couple short. And it's just maddening, right? Mm-hmm. Because if we had won that seat in North Carolina like we should have, why we can never knock Susan Collins out tells me we're running. I mean, I know it's not easy. She's an independent brand in a small state, but there we could have done more, I think. and so, you know, but now we're on the clock for democracy, too.
And by the way, let me mention Susan Collins. She's in a state where people ignore her voting record. And that's the key is the Republicans' voting record is constantly ignored by them because they're not voting for the person, they're voting for the party. And that's one thing that's hurt the Democrats is they're not challenging that and making people realize what these people have done. When you look at the map for 2022, there are a few seats I'm a little concerned for the Democrats. Nevada is a little concerned. Georgia, of course. Maybe New Hampshire as well. But the reality is that the Republicans actually have a much harder map to hold. The seats that, for the most part, for the Democrats are relatively safe seats. It's it's Wisconsin, and Ron Johnson is up, and he is not popular in Wisconsin. Nope. Pennsylvania, Florida.
That's an open seat. Yeah, and that should be a very good opportunity. Rubio should be a very good opportunity in Florida.
Yeah, Missouri as well. And as Missouri is,
Missouri and Ohio, which are again have moved in a red direction. Missouri even more so than Ohio, but are both states where Democrats can win. Have either won like Sherrod Brown or have come close. I mean, when Jason Kander ran against Blunt 6 years ago, he only lost by 3 points. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he ran a great race. It's doable. If you run the right kind of race, so yeah. I mean, they theoretically should have a tougher time defending than we should.
I think the big thing that is going to play on this, and by all means, take your time on this, because I think Trump is really the wild card because, let's face it, he is falling out of popularity. McConnell going after him, and I am not a fan of Mitch McConnell, but, you know, McConnell kind of had, a Scrooge moment where all of a sudden the ghost woke him up. I mean, here's Biden in his state trying to help out the tornado victims, and here's Trump basically talking about how Mitch McConnell should be fired immediately. And, I mean, I'm not a McConnell fan, but like I said, I mean, there seemed to be a wake-up moment there where he's like, okay.
What did McConnell say? I have to ask, honestly. I didn't see it.
He basically, you know, as nice as Republicans can, and I'll paraphrase, it was, you know, I don't think we should be listening necessarily to the former president when it comes to a lot of these issues of candidacy. It should be the best qualified candidate. And Trump was more infuriated. How dare you don't bow down to me, which a lot of people in the Republican Party are. It's clear that if Trump is a major player in this upcoming election, that that's not going to be the uniting factor the Republicans think it's going to be. And that could end up dooming them in a lot of these races.
Well, absolutely could have. I mean, he could, I mean to say. I mean, look at what he's doing. You know, he said that at some point he'd rather have Stacey Abrams be governor than Brian Kemp. I mean, again, Brian Kemp, imagine a worse right-wing troll. But he didn't overturn. I mean, the only difference between Brian Kemp and DeSantis in Florida is that Trump didn't have to order him to overturn anything because he won Florida. You know what I mean? All the Kemp happened to, and the same with Ducey in Arizona, for that matter. They both happened to be in the states that flipped to us, and so Trump, of course, expected their loyalty that they would cheat and break the law and abrogate the Constitution and steal those states, and they weren't willing to. That's with all the things they're willing to do, all the voter suppression, all the other ugly stuff they're willing to do. The actual saying, stealing of the actual electoral votes in the end, they were not willing to do. And to, you know, kind of like with what Mike Pence wasn't willing to do. And that's enough for Trump that you've betrayed him. So think about that. And I talked to you before we came on air and you were laughing about Bo Brooks apparently is now. I mean, the guy that got up literally and told him to kick whatever, because I don't think I can say the word here, kick bass, we'll say, and to go and encouraging people to go in the Capitol, a guy whose emails have been requested by the January 6th committee, or texts, I guess, because they figure he was texting with Meadows, a guy that may, who's certainly a seditionist and may in fact be held responsible legally for it. But that's not far enough for Trump, because he, at some point more recently, he started saying we need to put 2020 behind us. If you're not willing to relitigate 2020 every stinking day, because that's then you're not willing to say that Donald Trump won and his ego can't accept the fact that he lost. So, yeah, we've got a mentally unhinged character in Trump, as we've had for a long time. And you don't know what ways that are going to play out. That may give us all sorts of races. If he can't get behind Brian Kemp in Georgia and Mo Brooks in Alabama, think of the people he can undermine in numerous of these states where there are going to be choices between people that maybe – he's doing it already, for classic examples, in Alaska. Can we win Alaska? I have no idea. Mm-hmm. But he's already supporting the challenger against Lisa Murkowski.
Yeah, exactly.
And trying to destroy her. And may work. And I don't know. You know, it might be time for somebody like, what was his name? Mark Begich, or I don't know who. Somebody who has won in Alaska before, to come, you know, as a Democrat, to come back and run. Because maybe you have a chance.
Yeah.
You know? I think you're right.
If the Democrats can somehow, I mean, and like I said, I'm not putting it past, because Trump really is toxic poison. If the Democrats could hold the House, I mean, it would be historic, not completely historic. I mean, it would be very rare that the incumbent president picks up seats in the midterm. But, you know, if Trump goes in there and basically poisons the watering hole, Democrats hold the House, really all you need is two more seats. And especially in these states where Democrats really want to pick up, like a Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, if they pick those seats up, guess what? I think that then Manchin and Sinema become irrelevant.
They do. I mean, obviously, we have to hold the House too.
Yeah,
is the concern. I think there's a better chance that we gain Senate seats than there is that we hold the House right now.
Yeah,
and that's due to gerrymandering and the rest. If we can get Joe Manchin again to sign on to, you know, which is the big question, to allowing us to have a democracy. I mean, to me, that's even more important than Build Back Better, which is very important. But let's start with, we need to have a democracy, which means we need to pass the things that are destroying us. Voter suppression, the combination of voter suppression and gerrymandering, are making it so that we have all sorts of extremists who are winning. And obviously, let's not even talk about some of these places that are putting the voting counts in partisan hands so they can just throw votes out. I mean, that's utterly ludicrous.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, that those three things have to be solved. And if they are, at least we've got a fighting chance.
Yeah.
And you know, then they wouldn't be able to steal the number of seats they're able to in the House. Mm. But that's what they're working on right now. And in some states, I mean, from what I hear, I don't think, unless there's a federal law, they will not be able to undo it in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Here in Ohio, we were lucky enough that we elected three Democratic Supreme Court justices over the last two cycles on a 7-seat court. And there's a fourth who's like an actual old school moderate Republican from the, you know, the 80s, 90s have been on there for a while in his last term, who's the leader of the court. Why the word's not coming to me, I apologize. And he is actually sided against gerrymandering in the past. He's a reasonable guy, and it looks like we also passed a constitutional amendment that we forced our legislature into passing because we were going to pass something much stronger in a referendum, and they knew it. Their whole scheme may get overturned here, and it may in some other states too.
Well,
but we don't have the national law. We're in trouble, is what I'm saying.
We could talk for 3 hours, dude. I mean, we really could. Cliff Schechter, once again, Unprecedented is the podcast. You can find that at Patreon. Blue Amp Strategies, if you have a message that you want to get out, especially with a political campaign in 2022, get in touch with Blue Amp Strategies. I'll make sure I link to everything on social media. Cliff Schechter, Cliff, as always, a pleasure. We make sure we have you back on in the new year to talk about the latest happenings, okay?
Let's do it. Thanks for having me on, buddy. I really appreciate it.
My absolute...
You know, all that happy stuff, merry stuff, Christmases, New Year's, anything else you celebrate that's fun, you know, all of that.
Thank you, Cliff. I appreciate it. We'll take a break. Come on back. The Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.